we have seen is, sadly, I say this as a Democrat and an Obama supporter, that in the end, they know he'll fold. In the end, they know he'll compromise. That's another reason they're not worried about the trigger. I want to raise another quick issue, David, which is,
sure.
I wonder about the constitutionality of the super committee. I haven't heard anybody else talk about that, but who elected these people to have these superpowers where they can come up with $1.5 trillion worth of cuts that the Congress must vote on? Nobody ever gave him those extraordinary powers.
Yeah, boy. Actually, they did, Bill Press. I love you, buddy. You've been on my show a bunch of times, but I swear to God, you are so out to lunch on this one. Again, the musings of Bill Press. Of course, this is David Schuster sitting in for Keith Oberman discussing the so-called Super Congress, the special committee tasked with fixing the deficit. This also included, again, Bill Press, host of the Bill Press Show on Countdown. Bill Press has been questioning if the super committee is constitutional. Maybe yours, Alan Nathan, the militant moderate. Once again, this is the oasis for those who have an aversion to the left, right, black, white, two-dimensional approach. Delighted you could be on board. And we have so much we're getting into. We have the fact that there's a major GOP presidential primary debate tonight in Iowa. Will they weigh in against each other as much as they will against the president? I don't know. Also, Obama had plenty of criticism for Congress today in Michigan, but none for his own branch. Where's that balance about which he so often preaches? And how does Obama get reelected if he cannot run on his record? Remember, David Plouffe, super political guru that he is, said that Obama will not have to run on his record, but rather he will only have to run against the candidate who wins the Republican nomination. I think that's a rather foolhardy wish. To say that his record will not be part of the equation is taken naivete to new masturbatory heights. And Texas Governor Rick Perry's campaign states that he's in the race and that he'll officially announce his candidacy this Saturday. What will that mean for the contest? The Sistemi and the Opining, one of my regulars who's been gone for a little bit, but he is now back. I understand that rehab has been abridged these days. Doesn't last quite as long. Mark Levine.
It wasn't rehab, Alan. It was on a well-deserved vacation.
Yeah, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more, say no more. Anyway, a former congressional attorney and Washington, D.C. radio host on Pacifica Radio's WPFW. You can learn more about Mark at www.marklevineradio.com. Mark may be a lefty, but we love each other. And actually, we have the shared experience of both having hosted the same international television show called The American Dream. But that's for another program because, boy, do we need some time to get into that. Mark Levine, good having you back, buddy. How are you?
I'm good. We should discuss that someday, Alan, when there's less news going on.
Yes, yes. And I don't think that particular criterion, I should say, has been achieved at this date. Because,
no, boy,
if there's ever a lot going on, it's today as we speak. Let me ask you, you just heard the musings of Bill Press. What do you think of his position thinking that the super committee is somehow a violation of the Constitution? Apparently, he hasn't heard of Article 1, Section 5, wherein each house may determine the rules of its own proceedings. You're a lawyer, and I've learned to forgive you for that, by the way. What's your view of this?
You know, it's an interesting question. I have to say, I hadn't really thought about it, but now that he raised it, I think it's an interesting question. This is a joint committee. Now, the way things normally work in Congress, of course, is each House does set its own rules. The Senate has its committees. It decides what to accept from its committees. The House decides what to accept from its committees. But can the House and the Senate together make a joint committee? I think they can, and then they can vote on it in its regular basis. They can certainly do that because it would be just like a regular bill. But can they bind themselves in advance to something that hasn't been done yet and say that if it's not done by the super committee, that suddenly there's an automatic trigger? I don't know. I actually think it raises a reasonable constitutional question.
Well, the trigger that was agreed upon is binding because that actually took part. That was part of the budget, the Balanced Budget Act that Obama signed.
So if the trigger is binding, can Congress say then that it could certainly pass something to undo its own trigger? It certainly can do that.
Well, it can always do that. That's how come you can never bind a future Congress.
Well, right, right. So it has this trigger that's coming, and then it passes.
Well, let me rephrase that. You can't bind a future Congress from being allowed to repeal whatever it is you passed as law. Now, unless they repeal it, yes, then all laws are binding, even in subsequent Congresses. You can bind a future Congress to that extent, but you can't bind a future Congress to the extent that you get to dictate to them how they may or may not repeal whatever bill it is that you passed in the time of discussion.
No, I agree that the trigger's binding. I accept that. But okay. My question is, Congress has said that whatever the super committee comes up with, they're going to agree in advance. For example, it won't be subject to filibuster rules. They've also agreed that you can't have amendments. They've agreed that in advance. I don't know that they can do that. I think they're going to have to pass
rules.
Well,
the filibuster is not the filibuster. The filibuster isn't required by the Constitution. It's allowed by because of Article 1, Section 5. Again, each branch, each chamber may determine the rules of its own proceedings. So if they want to have a filibuster, they can, but it's not a mandate of the Constitution.
Now, let me ask you this. Let's say that the super committee comes up with something. It comes up with Plan X. And then a group of senators decide they want to filibuster it. Well, according to ordinary rules, they can filibuster it. Can you bind a Congress in advance to not filibuster something that they haven't seen yet? I don't know, because Senate rules say that you can filibuster anything except for, you know, very specific things, reconciliation and so forth. So it may be in violation of the Senate rules, which, as you say, the House and the Senate can set their own rules under the Constitution.
There you go. So, see, that's ultimately what it comes down to, and I think the ultimate rub, or the eventual rub, if you will, would be at the mercy of that dynamic. I don't see how to wiggle out.
The Senate can't change its rules without a two-thirds vote. So it actually gets quite kind of complicated. I don't claim to have an answer on this one. I hadn't really put to a lot of thought, but I do think it raises a serious issue, interestingly.
Now, I want to ask you about something else. A lot of folks are angry with President Obama, and it's been kind of relentless. But what I find bizarre is that a lot of the criticism has been coming from the left in a fashion that actually has a sort of generic agreement with the GOP, and that is the charge of weak leadership. You may have heard MSNBC's Chris Matthews derided Obama for not ever having put a plan on paper to counter the GOP's well-documented proposal. Remember, there were three of them. You had, of course, the Ryan pathway to prosperity. You had the cut bunch, the cut cap and bounce, or whatever it was called. Yeah, the cut cap and bounce. And then finally, you had the Balanced Budget Act. And then, of course, it was subjected to changes, and it came back from Reid, and the rest is history. So they at least had those. And Chris Matthews, while he didn't like any of them, he was upset with Obama for not having put a plan together on his own that would counter the GOP. And as you might recall, the Democrats all along were saying, oh, he's got a plan. Well, he never had a plan. He had a framework, but he never actually had a hard plan. As a matter of fact, Maureen Dowd says the president has been so spectacularly unable to fill the leadership void in Washington that the high-spirited Michelle Bachmann feels free to purloin Obama's old mantra. And then, of course, she quotes Congresswoman Bachmann saying that the power behind our campaign is hope and a future. But Dowd also says, and I quote, he doesn't lead, meaning Obama. He doesn't lead, and he doesn't understand why we don't feel led, unquote. How are these observations playing in the land of liberals, Mark Levine?
Well, first of all, I would say there clearly was a framework. You can't have a plan because the Democrats can't pass anything without a filibuster by the Republicans, although Reid did pass something, and so that was the Senate plan. But the framework for Obama was actually the framework supported by 75% of Americans, which is
he never came up with anything.
We need to end these tax breaks for the rich. We need to end these special breaks for billionaires, hedge fund companies. And
you're never
going to
get anywhere if you only cite half the polls, not the other half. Don't forget, contrary to the Democrats' preference and much to their aggregate chagrin, in poll after poll after poll, the vast majority of Americans said they would not go through with a debt ceiling increase unless it were attached to spending cuts. That's also another part of the equation, and that part of the equation was something the Democrats were vehemently against until they had to be dragged kicking and screaming into the very acquiescence they so richly deserved. Stick with us. You're with Battleline Main Street. I'm Alan Nathan. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. I'm ever yours, Alan Nathan. We're continuing our conversation with Mark Levine. He's former congressional attorney and Washington, D.C. radio host on Pacifica Radio's WPFW. We're talking about this major GOP presidential primary debate that's going on in Iowa tonight. Will they weigh in against each other as much as they will against the president? Well, Mark Levine, what say you? Will that happen or not?
Well, I think they'll go after each other, and I think they'll go after the president. I do want to respond real quick, if I could, to some of the things you said going out, Alan. One about the polls. There's a fascinating poll, not only that 70%+ of Americans believe we need to raise taxes and specifically raise tax on the wealthy, close that loophole to save the budget, that even the majority of Tea Party supporters, even 53% of Tea Party supporters, thought we needed to raise taxes, cut those tax loopholes, and so forth. I thought
well,
that was
the two, that's where you see, I'm thinking we have a potential out here. We really do. We have a potential out here if we play it safe, if we play it smartly. And I think it's probably going to be through those tax expenditures. And I don't believe it'll be long before we see a lot more people. I mean, what we're essentially looking at is people like Senator Coburn saying, hey, these tax expenditures, if they're removed, they're not analogous to the removal of tax hikes. They're not analogous to the injection of tax increases. And he says, because as long as we have them, we have some iniquities in place. And I agree with that. And I think if we went with that approach, we could have a circumstance in which, because there's going to be a tonnage of cuts, there has to be a tonnage of cuts. There's a mythical equivalency saying that there's a greater, that there's just as much debt reduction potential through tax increases as there is through spending cuts. It just doesn't pass the laugh test. Anybody with even a rudimentary passing familiarity with math knows that's impossibly
impossibly
difficult to prove.
Spending.
Right, what's that?
Obviously, we can raise infinite number of taxes, but there's only so much spending we can cut. So obviously, they're not the same. But
No. It's the other way around. We can cut more than we can raise in taxes because you could go ahead and tax all the millionaires of this country at 100%, and it wouldn't be a drop in a bucket next to what we're facing here. $1.6 trillion in a deficit, $14 trillion in national debt. Forget it. I mean, if you were to use a visual representation, if you were to use...
We had a massive surplus then, as far as the eye could see.
What's that again?
Well, just go back to the rates of the Clinton years. At that time, we had a surplus as far as the eye could see. I remember George W. Bush arguing in 2001, I was in Congress at the time, that our surpluses were so huge that we were going to not only pay down the entire national debt, but we're going to have so much money we won't even have any place to put it all, and that's how he justified his massive tax cuts. And I argued that was ridiculous at that time. But all we have to do is go back to the Clinton rates, and we will have massive surpluses as far as the eye can see, that and to pay for our two wars that we didn't pay for.
Well, you have to remember, during Clinton, he, too, added about $3 trillion to our national debt. The problem is the surplus we had was in the yearly surplus. It didn't touch the national debt. The national debt didn't go down a dime.
The national debt.
Huh?
Right. It reduced the national debt. That's what a budget surplus does. In the last 3 years of Bill 98, 99, 2000, the national debt was reduced because we had a budget surplus.
But for his presidency, he had a net increase of the national debt, and that's a matter of history. I can't change it. I mean, trying to debate that.
You're saying net because coming out of the first George Bush, see, whenever you have a recession, it always harms the deficit. It always does because less people are paying taxes, more money is going out. So the recession for George Bush Sr., Clinton had to pay for that and get us out of that. And then he, by 96, 97, 98, he was running a surplus. But I also address your question about leadership, if I could. Because I think that you're right, and Maureen Down is right, that liberals are very upset with President Obama right now. We don't think he's shown leadership. We think he allowed the children to play with fire.
I got to stop you right there. But part of the area in which he refused to show leadership and is now being condemned by the liberals was the area involving whether or not he put up a plan. That was the biggest bitch that the GOP had. They came up with three plans. Now, you may disagree with their plans. That's fine. But if you scoff at it without coming up with something of your own, I cannot take you seriously. I cannot take you seriously if instead of being on the field of play, all you're doing is shouting mouthfuls of heinous rhetoric from the sidelines. You're either in the game, on the field, or you're on the sidelines shouting, and all the president was doing was putting himself on the sidelines shouting. He did not have a formal plan, and that's one of the things that Maury Dowd criticized him about. That's one of the things that Chris Matthews also criticized him about.
I don't think that was the big issue at all. I don't think.
But it was an issue. I mean, it didn't have to be the biggest to be an issue. What I'm saying is he was caught red-handed lying out of his goddamn ass. He lied out of his goddamn ass. He said he had a plan, and he didn't. He said he had a plan and he didn't. This guy was such a douchebag. He reminded me of the kind of person you find at a poker game who expects the same player to raise himself before the other guy bets once. This man did not have a single tactile piece of paper with a plan written on it submitted to the people. It was all through rhetoric. And rhetoric, of course, as you know, has no real standards to it, because any time you have standards that are themselves predicated on seemingly never-ending variables, you know what you've got? Nothing. Nada. Zilch. You can't point to his plan, Mark Levine. You know you can't, because even Maureen Down and Chris Matthews said he never came up with one.
Alan, for 4 months, President Obama, specifically Vice President Biden, negotiated daily with John Boehner, with Eric Cantor, with all of them, putting plan after proposed plan after proposed plan on the table.
Nothing ever formalized that had to be defended in public. Nothing ever formalized that had to be defended in public. Nothing ever formalized that had to be defended in public. He never had a tactile piece of paper that had to be defended in public. What he talked about behind closed doors is the epitomizing of apple-orange comparison. You're going to juxtapose three tactile proposals that are empirically verifiable. They're on the international stage for everybody with a working cardiovascular system to see. Two, what are you going to compare that to? Two, nothing but rhetoric, closed doors discussions, and you're going to try to actually argue that there's this mythical equivalency between the two? It doesn't pass the laugh test.
By vast numbers, that the American people think that Barack Obama compromised with Republicans, he compromised way too much, and they're very upset with the Republicans for refusing to compromise. Their issue is not that Obama didn't compromise with them. Their issue is that he compromised too much. And specifically what he should have done is he should have cited the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which said the validity of the public debt shall not be in question, and said, I'm not going to play this game.
It was an irrelevant reference. You know that because nobody has to be... I'm not going to play. The bizarre thing here is that you're using a disconnected measure. It's like trying to measure distance with a scale or measure, if you will, weight with a ruler. That passage of the 14th Amendment is simply having not the least infinitesimal correlative relevance to what was at the center of the debate of the debt ceiling argument. Why is that? Because nobody was questioning our debt. What we were questioning was the mode that we would use in the payment of that debt. And
no,
that is a very different discussion.
Actually, Alan, what Congress did is Congress, back in 08,
when Obama said he couldn't do it, Obama admitted that it wasn't constitutional.
Well, Obama decided not to pull that card. I think he was wrong. Most liberals think he was wrong. Clinton thinks he was wrong. And I dare say most independents think he was wrong, too, to allow our economy to collapse because Republicans were playing with fire.
With fire, they were using ultimate leverage.
About it.
You do realize this is going to happen again, don't you? Right, my friend? You do know this is going
to
happen again, right?
To spend so much, I'm going to spend so much.
You do know this is going to happen again, right? You know the debt ceiling is going to be used as leverage from this point on. And
right,
I kind of
so
like that because
that precedent, and that's
it's going to be there forever. Look at it. Why? You want people to apologize for being successful. You want people to feel embarrassed about using that which has proven to have efficacy. Decade in and decade out, the debt ceiling debate has done nothing but further enable the very bad spending we're now having to curtail. This is the very first time that the debt ceiling was used as leverage to curtail additional spending versus further enabling it. Whether you like it or not, I think we all have to acknowledge that using the debt ceiling as leverage is a position and a strategy that's here to stay. Would you not agree?
Alan, people are suffering. We lost $9 trillion in the stock market last week because Republicans were playing with fire. The entire world economy is verging on collapse because Republicans are playing with fire. This was a terrible idea. I know they're gleeful about it. I know they say, hey, we threatened to, Armageddon on the economy and we got what we wanted. And what did we get? We got economic Armageddon anyway. We're already seeing this in the markets. We're seeing this.
Well, you're skipping a few things, though. You're skipping a few things. Look, while Democrats had popularized the need to approve the debt ceiling increase as synonymous with saving our AAA credit rating, let's face it, people may have missed the fact that the rating agencies were calling for us to also achieve at least $4 trillion in addition to raising the debt ceiling. Now, given that reality, has been confirmed and reconfirmed over and over again by S&P's David Beers, head of the company's Sovereign and International Public Finance Ratings, why does the administration and fellow Democrats continue altering facts to fit a narrative that simply can't stand up to scrutiny? It took both things,
lifting the debt ceiling and reducing
our debt by $4 trillion. The Democrats only want to emphasize the former. The Republicans only want to emphasize the latter. The centrists of the universe understand that both were true. Why can't you? Why can't you and the far right acknowledge that both were part and parcel of what was required to dodge our AAA rating be reduced?
I want to answer. For 70 years, we raised the debt ceiling without this collapse. The only reason for the collapse is what the S&P called political brinksmanship, and that's entirely the fault of the Republicans.
And they said the $4 trillion not appropriately brought down. That was the other thing. They said debt ceiling and $4 trillion. Debt ceiling and $4 trillion. The two. You remember the Gestalt theory, right? The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. You cannot take a peripheral observation, infer it as if it were a conclusive analysis, and think you're going to be taken seriously when you then try to convey it as such. Not going to happen. Folks, stick with us. Got some words coming live from Iowa. You are with Battleline, Main Street Radio Network.